Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's just about evening here in London. It's just gone 6 p.m. Pleasure to have the chance to speak to you today. And I'm sorry I can't just nip across the Atlantic for the talk. But today, what I want to talk to you about is at the interface of gravitational wave science and cosmology. And in particular, we'll be talking about what we can do for gravitational wave cosmology without standard sirens, or as an alternative to standard sirens. Standard sirens, of course, are gravitational wave events with EM counterparts. And they are something of the poster child for gravitational wave cosmology. So we're trying to go beyond that for reasons that hopefully will become clear shortly. We'll do this in three parts today. We'll start off by reviewing a bit about why standard sirens are exciting, but also some of the challenges that we have with them. And that will motivate us to look into the alternative techniques. And I will spend a fair bit of today explaining in some detail a technique called dark sirens. And then finally, if we get time at the end, we can talk a bit about how these techniques can be used beyond kind of mainstream cosmology, perhaps to test modified gravity theories. This is not a collaboration talk, but a lot of the things I'll be talking about are done by myself and by others within the LIGO Scientific Collaboration and the LISA Consortium. And also a lot of this work is really driven forward by my fantastic team of PhD and postdoctoral researchers at Queen Mary. So here they all are. Okay, just before we get started, I think it's worth just reminding ourselves of the current gravitational wave catalogue of detections. I really like this sort of periodic table style plot. So it shows all the events, 91 of them, listed chronologically from top left to bottom right. And the colours of blue are indicating the different observing runs. And for each event, you've got in the two corners, you've got the objects involved in the merger, and in the centre, you've got the remnant left afterwards. And for everything, the numbers given underneath are the best measured masses in terms of solar masses. Black is obviously a black hole. Blue means a neutron star. And in a few places, there are things that are sort of half black and half blue. And that means we're not 100% sure what that thing is. So the first and only standard siren to date, you'll notice we got really quite early on in terms of this catalogue. That's up here, GW170817. And not only was it the first standard siren, it was actually also the first binary neutron star merger. I also today want to draw your attention to another event sitting down here in the middle of the third observing run. It's 190814. It's most famously known as being the mass gap event, because one of the objects involved at 2.6 solar masses was heavier than we would expect for a neutron star and lighter than we would expect for a black hole. So it's sort of technically falls in where people think there's a mass gap. Now, that's actually not the reason I'm interested in it today. It just happens to also be one of the loudest events we've detected. And that means it was very well localized on the sky. And it's that part of things that will become relevant to today's talk later on. Okay, but with that kind of brief glimpse of the catalogue out the way, let's talk about these standard sirens, which we said were gravitational wave events with an electromagnetic counterpart. And we won't distinguish too much today about exactly where on the EM spectrum those counterparts that counterpart falls. And of course, the canonical system that we think would give rise to standard sirens is a pair of merging neutron stars, because we don't expect to get many photons out of black holes. Okay, so leaving aside all the incredible astrophysics you can do with these objects, why are they exciting for cosmology? So to explain that, I've got on the slide here an expression for the amplitude of a gravitational wave. And this could be either the plus or the cross polarization. And I've made all the simplifying assumptions. So this is a pair of binary black holes, circular orbit, non-spinning, no precession, lowest post-Newtonian order. And so what appears in this amplitude is the chirp mass, so the particular combination of masses in the binary, and it's actually the redshifted chirp mass. Again, we'll see that later. There's the frequency of the gravitational wave. There's a bunch of angular factors to do with polarization and inclination. But what we care about today is the object sitting on the denominator, which is the luminosity distance. And the luminosity distance is given by this hopefully familiar formula used in cosmology that relates it to redshift. Now, the key thing about this formula is that it depends on the Hubble factor here. So the Hubble factor, of course, contains some of the most important parameters in cosmology. So just writing down a simple example, here's the Hubble factor for a universe with cold dark matter and some kind of dark energy component. And just for argument's sake, I've allowed it not to be a cosmological constant, to be something else. And so H naught, omega m, and the equation of state of dark energy all sit in this relation. And that means if we have ways to measure both variables that are in this relation, so luminosity distance on the left and redshift appearing in multiple places on the right, we have a way to constrain the parameters sitting in here. So, of course, that's particularly exciting in the case of the Hubble constant, which we all know is significantly in tension these days. So you get the luminosity distance from your gravitational waveform, the redshift you can get from your electromagnetic counterpart in the case of a standard siren. So here's the counterpart of 170817 as seen by Hubble, and you can see it fading over a period of about a week here. And putting those things together, as we say, you've got a way to measure the Hubble constant that is independent of the current CMB and distance ladder measurements. And maybe, just maybe, if you get lucky, you can be the person who solves the Hubble tension with this method. And for that, you probably get a lot of fame and prizes and glory. So it's no surprise that the LIGO-Virgo-Kagra collaboration tried to do this measurement with 170817. Here is the result, and many of you probably will have seen this plot when it was first published 5 years ago now. So this is the posterior on the Hubble constant from 170817. And you can see it peaks ever so diplomatically between the two bands in the background here, which is the CMB measurement in green and a strong lensing measurement in orange. Now, of course, in reality, the width of this distribution is too large to discriminate between these two other measurements at the moment. It's about plus or minus 10 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So with one data point, we're not getting a competitive constraint on the Hubble constant. No one's really surprised by that. But it works as a proof of principle. And you can imagine that if we had more of these standard sirens and we started combining them, we'd start to shrink those error bars and then potentially we'd be in business. That's not all you can do with a standard siren. If instead you're not too worried about the Hubble constant, another thing that can affect the luminosity distance redshift relation is deviations from GR on cosmological scales. So using exactly the same ideas, you could instead use the data to detect or constrain deviations from GR. And again, if you are able to detect some of those, you know, fame and prizes and glory are yours. So those are the reasons, or some of the reasons, that standard sirens are really exciting for cosmology. However, it's not all quite as rosy as that. So the obvious question to ask is, how many standard sirens would I need to get a competitive, so a sort of percent level constraint on the Hubble constant? And we can only ballpark this answer right now, but estimates put that at something like 50 to 100 standard sirens. Now, the rate of standard sirens is unknown, right? It's very hard to measure a rate with one data point. So should we just sort of wait to collect this, you know, this stack of standard sirens? And you can probably guess from the title of my talk that I'm going to argue the answer should be no. There are definitely other things we want to do in the meantime. So thinking about this, if you just use standard sirens, you're really ignoring the vast majority of the incredible gravitational wave data set we have. Right, you're just using these, not even all of the events down here, just a very select handful, and ignoring all these beautiful binary black holes. Surely there must be some way we can do cosmology with them. Secondly, EM counterparts, of course, are most detectable at low redshifts. That's fine if you're constraining the Hubble constant. But if you want to do some of these tests of GR, some of those really benefit from having gravitational wave sources at higher redshifts. You get a kind of longer lever arm for the things you're trying to test in that case. And of course, the higher redshifts you go to, the harder it's going to be to see those EM counterparts. And finally, right now, we really have no idea, or almost no idea, a very hazy idea, how long it could take to collect enough standard sirens to make this percent level measurement. And call me impatient, but I don't want to just sort of sit around for 10, 15, however long years, waiting for these to build up. So for all these reasons, it makes sense for us to ask, what can we do? And really, I mean, what can we do for cosmology, of course, without an electromagnetic counterpart? And that's what I want to tell you about next. So this is the technique that goes by the name of dark sirens. Sometimes you'll also hear the word statistical sirens, or just occasionally it gets called the galaxy catalog method, which I think is like a really sort of kind of bland sounding name for what I think is a really lovely idea. So I'm going to explain this idea, and we'll do it in increasing levels of sophistication. So we'll talk about it conceptually, then we'll build that out a little bit more. We'll take a quick look at some of the mathematics, and finally I'll show you some of the actual results from this method.
So what's the picture in the middle?
The picture in the middle, but I'm getting there. I'm getting there. Okay. So the conceptual explanation of dark sirens is basically laid out by this series of three pictures. Okay. So probably everyone's seen a sky map up the top, showing the localization contours of a gravitational wave event. And this looks like 2D information, but actually there is some radial sensitivity in the data. So there's actually three-dimensional information here. And so this thing in the middle is the projection of these localization contours. And I deliberately chose a very badly localized event for this. It's the projection into three dimensions. So you should imagine that the observer is sitting at the center here, and these are the localization volumes of space for this event. Now, you can go point a telescope at those volumes of space, or if you're really lucky, somebody has already pointed a telescope at those volumes of space and you have a galaxy catalog. And one way or another, you can get redshift measurements for all the galaxies, and there could be thousands or tens of thousands of them sitting in these localization volumes. Now, that actually means you do have sitting somewhere on your hard drive the redshift of the gravitational wave event, because it happened inside one of these galaxies. Your problem is that you don't know which is the true host galaxy, and so you don't know which is the correct redshift of the event. And remember, in the case of the standard sirens, that's what the EM counterpart provided. It provided that sort of unambiguous single redshift measurement. So the basic concept of the dark sirens method is that we're going to marginalize our constraints over all the possible host galaxy redshifts within our localization volumes. Okay, let me make that a little bit more fleshed out. We'll talk about this a bit more, and sometimes it's helpful to pretend we live in a universe that's governed by Hubble's law. Okay, obviously we don't do this with the actual data, but at low redshifts, the luminosity distance redshift relation basically becomes Hubble's law. And that's just helpful here because there's only one parameter involved, which is the Hubble constant. Okay, so the data we have in hand is the galaxy distribution, right? And we can look along individual lines of sight through the sky, and we can plot the galaxies as a function of redshift. Please forgive my hand-drawn sketches here. But you'll get some lumpy, bumpy distribution where this could be some large cluster, and next to it here, this could be some void. In addition to that data, which is in redshift space, we have the gravitational wave data for a given event, which gives us this broad distribution in luminosity distance. Right? This is the luminosity distance that we've inferred from doing parameter estimation on the gravitational wave data. And of course, what links these two scales, at least in our simple Hubble's law universe, is the Hubble constant. So let's pretend that for a low value of the Hubble constant, that matches up the peak of the green distribution to some particular point on the redshift axis here. Now, because this is a really broad distribution in green, we can't really just look at the peak position. We actually have to consider some kind of two sigma volume around the peak. And what the dark sirens method is going to do, and I'll sort of put this on a mathematical footing in a moment, is it's going to give you a prescription for calculating how much support there is for this gravitational wave data having come from a galaxy with a redshift between these two pink lines. Now, if we make the simplifying assumption that all galaxies are equally likely to host gravitational wave events, and we don't actually do that in the real analysis, but we can just do it that way for now, this basically amounts to kind of integrating over and summing up how many possible host galaxies there are between these lines. And that gives us that calculation, which I'll show you, returns for us some value of support for that low value of the Hubble constant. And of course, then what we're going to do is we're going to crank up the Hubble constant. That's equivalent to sliding these two distributions past each other. And again, we evaluate how much support is there for the two distributions being linked by this value. Okay, and now our gravitational wave data is aligned with some big piece of large scale structure, lots of galaxies, we get a higher value of support. Okay, and finally, I think you've got the idea by now, you can crank up the Hubble constant one stage further, and again, there'll be some other value of the support. And so what we've got out at the end of the day is some really loose, really broad kind of posterior distribution on the Hubble constant, given how much support it has from these two distributions overlapping. Now, you'd be right to be thinking that surely this is really, really noisy, right? We could have our host galaxy, let's say, in this little piece of structure here, And any other big lump of large-scale structure along the line of sight would skew your distribution away from the kind of true host, the true true Hubble constant value. And that's true. Any one line of sight in any one event is subject to a lot of noise. But the power of this method is that we will throw the kitchen sink at it. So we will combine all lines of sight for all the events that we use. And the real constraining power will come from basically stacking all that data. Before I do that, let me express this a little bit more mathematically. So there is a full hierarchical Bayesian formalism that underpins this whole method. I'm not going to take you through all of that today because the full calculation is just, you know, too much Bayes to put on slides, basically. But we'll look at a kind of toy version of it. And the full thing, of course, is in the papers here. So the toy version, Bayes theorem, we want our posterior for the Hubble constant given some set of gravitational wave data. So we can Bayes that up. And of course, what that converts our problem to is evaluating the likelihood here, which is the likelihood for the data given a value of the Hubble constant. Now, our gravitational wave events are well separated in time and space, so we can treat them as independent. So really, this is a product of individual likelihoods for each event. So now what we need to calculate is this object for one gravitational wave event. Now, I'm not going to derive this expression for you. I'm just going to present it and kind of hopefully convince you it's sort of physically sensible. The likelihood for this object is given by a triple integral. So it's an integral over redshift. It will also be an integral over galaxy magnitude for reasons we'll see in a moment. And it's going to be an integral over the sky. And this sky position is going to be just denoted by this object omega. And what's sitting inside this integral? Two objects. The first one is the likelihood of getting that data coming from an event at a particular redshift and Hubble constant. Now, in reality, of course, we think of gravitational wave data as a function of luminosity distance, but as we've seen, a luminosity distance basically converts into a redshift for a given value of the Hubble constant. So this is nothing other than that green broad distribution I had a moment ago, which I said was returned to me by my parameter estimation pipeline. Now we have to multiply that by some likelihood for the gravitational wave event being at that redshift in the first instance. And of course, the data about that will come from our galaxy catalog. That will tell us the selection of possible host redshifts that could have hosted the event. And so that's the nothing other than the red bumpy distribution we had on the previous slide. Now, crucially, you'll see that the magnitude of the galaxies is also appearing here because, of course, we don't see every possible galaxy. We'll only see the galaxies down to some magnitude threshold. And I'll take care of that in just a moment. Finally, out the front here, there's a very important factor which cancels out a kind of geometric effect. So if you crank up the Hubble constant, what you do is you push the inferred redshift of your gravitational wave data out to higher values. And of course, at higher redshifts, you've got more volume of space, you've got more potential host galaxies. So if we're assuming that all galaxies are equally likely to host for now, you would always get a biasing towards high values of the Hubble constant. And this geometric factor basically cancels out that trend. Okay, let's just talk a little bit about this magnitude issue. And really that relates to the fact that our galaxy catalogs are incomplete. And so really, in addition to all the galaxies we see, what we actually do for the redshift distribution is we have to weight that. So there's some sensible weighting here. We have to add to that some model for the galaxies that are missing, the ones we didn't see. And it's been shown in other works, and I won't go into this today, but it's been shown a sensible first guess is to distribute those missing galaxies as uniform in co-moving volume. Now that sounds really unphysical. It is really unphysical. You're just putting down those galaxies, faint galaxies on a grid. But what has been shown by other authors is that this doesn't bias the results. So it's not strongly informative, but it's also not biasing them. Indeed, some of my team are working on improving this model right now, because of course we know that those missing galaxies are actually clustered. And so where the magnitude limits come in is, of course, deciding the weighting between these two contributions. How far down in magnitude can you see? Okay, and also at this point, you could introduce some weights into the formalism. So if you don't want to assume that all galaxies are equally likely to be hosts, if you have some astrophysical model that says galaxies with really large stellar mass or really high luminosity are most likely to host gravitational wave events, you can fold that set of weights in here.
Tessa?
Yes.
Do you have a question? Would it make sense at some point to, instead of iterating over the massive galaxy distribution, to think of dark matter blob distribution, taking from, say, some illustrious simulation or something like that?
So I didn't hear all of that. I heard, I hope it makes sense, instead of the galaxy distribution to use, sorry, say again.
To use dark matter maps obtained, say, from simulations or from lensing or whatever.
I'm still missing words. Something mass obtained from lensing or simulations.
Yeah, dark matter.
Dark matter.
Yes.
So you mean to... Well, so you mean to correlate the galaxies with a dark matter distribution?
To correlate, yeah, the events with the cosmic web of the mass of dark matter.
Right. So indeed, people do look into that. That is definitely a probe for 3G detectors, so next generation gravitational wave detectors, because you need enough events for them actually to start being a tracer of cosmic structure. But people are working on that indeed. But what we're doing today is more at the level of individual events. But ultimately the two formalisms, there should be some way to make them, to move smoothly from one to the other, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, go on. Just ask maybe a related question. So yeah, so I guess what Louise was maybe getting out, and you were getting out as well, is the galaxies not in your catalog should be sort of correlated with the ones that are in your catalog, right? Because galaxies tend to cluster together. So can you put that information into this formalism to have like a better idea of where the missing ones might be?
Assuming I've heard all the words correctly, yes, exactly. And thank you for asking, because that's exactly what some of my team are working on right now, is filling in those missing galaxies in a way that is clustered, right? We measure two-point correlation functions of galaxies. That means given some distribution of observed galaxies, we do have some knowledge about where we expect the missing ones to be, at least in a statistically average sense. So yes, we are working on algorithms for doing that. However, they are not in the current pipelines. Not yet.
Yeah, thanks.
So, okay. So what is the reason that these galaxies are missing? It's because we have not surveyed this particular angle in the sky, and or it's too faint, or what are the reasons?
Too faint. It's nothing to do with angles. It's just simply that they are too faint. So your survey has some magnitude threshold limit below which you won't see all your little faint dwarfs and things like that. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Not hearing any more for now. Actually, I see somebody's written something in the chat. Okay, dark matter patterns. Yes, thank you. So let's look at some results, right? I think we've talked enough about the method. Let's look at the actual data. Skip that. Okay, so here are the real world versions of the things that I was doing my silly little sketches of. So these figures come from the LIGO Virgo Cagra 03 cosmology paper. So in red here, you have the real galaxy distribution that was used for a particular event. And the orange one is just a reweighted version of that. So that's the real world version of my red curve. And overlaid on top of that in green, here is the actual distance distribution for one event. Of course, it's actually in luminosity distance. Again, it's just been converted to redshift so it can go on the same axes. So that's the real world version of this thing over here. Here are the real world versions of my pink distribution. So this was the Hubble posterior you got along individual lines of sight. I didn't get the colors right on this one. So please ignore the pink dashed lines. We're talking about the blue ones. And I'm just showing you two events here, just picked at random. So what are all these blue fuzzy lines here? They are all the different lines of sight through the sky map. And what you'll see is that individual lines of sight indeed can be very broad. And also the peak can move around quite a lot. Right, and this is what we said, that the data is noisy for any one line of sight, but the power comes in stacking it. So stacking all that data, we use about 42 events from the current gravitational wave catalog. We don't use the very low signal to noise ones. We take the loudest ones. Here is the current results from this method. So in black, you've got the posterior from 170817, as we saw already. And in orange, you've got the dark sirens method. And in blue, you've got the combination of the two. Okay, and so you can see that with about 42 events, it looks like we've got a constraint which is about comparable to the standard siren. And so the blue is about, you know, twice as high and half as wide. And if that was the end of the story, I think this would be a done deal, right? We would definitely measure dark sirens. We would definitely measure the Hubble constant from the many, many black holes, binary black holes that we get for every standard siren event, and job would be done. Now, of course, there's something I'm leaving out, which makes life a little bit more complicated. And that's hiding in this very faint gray dotted curve here. And this gray curve pretty much overlaps with the orange dark sirens one. It's labeled K band on the axis, but it's the dark sirens method. They overlap except near the peak, where there's a bit of difference. And this gray curve is labeled empty catalog. Okay, those words sound a bit ominous. What we have done here is we've used all the dark sirens machinery, but we've completely scrubbed out the catalog. We've pretended we didn't see any galaxies. We just saw, we just fill in everything as a missing galaxy. So how come we've still got a constraint? The way I've explained it, the galaxy catalog is absolutely crucial to the dark sirens method. So what's actually going on here is the mass distribution of compact objects, right? So here we have a toy model for the mass distribution. So mass of the primary on the x-axis. There's some rates parameter on the y-axis that we won't worry about today. And what we've got at low masses is, of course, the binary neutron star population. Then there's that mass gap we talked about, the lower mass gap. And then we've got the main distribution of binary black holes. And it's got some shape, probably. We think there's a peak or a break or some feature around 30 solar masses. And then at the upper end, we believe that there is, a hypothesis is that there's another gap, the PISN gap, the pair instability supernova gap. And in this region, we don't expect to find compact objects, the theory says that the stars that would have given rise to compact objects in this range destroy themselves due to this particular pair instability process before they can leave behind a remnant. Okay, so this is not the data, this is just a model. Okay, what's that got to do with the Hubble constant? Well, remember I said earlier, what we actually measure from the data is not true masses, but redshifted masses. So we actually constrain this thing on the left, which is related to the true source frame mass by a factor of 1 + z. So the thing on the left is going to stay fixed. Let's say we've measured a luminosity distance. If we change the Hubble constant, that changes the redshift that luminosity distance corresponds to. And so if we crank up the Hubble constant, we'll crank up this redshift here. And therefore the inferred source frame mass will have to go down in order to keep the object on the left fixed. Okay, and vice versa if we decrease the Hubble constant. So effectively, what you do is you end up pushing inferred source frame masses up or down this distribution. And you can see what's going to happen here. If you push it up or down too far, you'll push your inferred mass into one of the mass gaps, and then it'll be disfavored. The value of the Hubble constant that pushed you into that gap where you don't expect events will be disfavored. Okay, so at first glance, this is kind of good news. Even without galaxy catalogs, the source frame mass distribution of compact objects gives us some information about the Hubble constant. And indeed, that is actually, in the present data, what is giving rise to this kind of overall bell shape here. And right now, and I stress that this is something that's going to improve in future, but right now what the galaxy catalog is actually buying you is just that little extra bit of leverage around the peak. The flip side of this means that you can't really disentangle cosmology and mass distribution. Really, if you want to constrain the Hubble constant, you have to simultaneously constrain all of the parameters that describe the locations of these gaps, the shape of the distribution here, etc. And for a long time, that was very challenging. So in the third observing run, we were not able to do that. I see someone's raised a hand, just give me a minute or two. So in the third observing run, this did not happen. We basically just fixed the mass distribution. It's been a major piece of work over the past 3 years to create a code, a likelihood code that could evaluate the likelihood for all those mass and cosmology parameters simultaneously. I used to give versions of this talk where I had to just leave it here. I'm pleased to say that that is now possible. There are in fact now two pipelines that can do this. One called GW Cosmo, which is what my team works with, and another one called Icaro GW. And basically by reworking completely the formalism inside these codes, they now evaluate about 1,000 times faster. And that means going forwards into the next observing run, we will be able to vary this whole parameter set as we should be doing for the first time. And it's also what's going to enable us to actually do these tests beyond Lambda CDM at the for the first time, because we can now handle more parameters. Okay, somebody had a hand up.
Yeah, I have two questions.
Okay.
Yes, can I go ahead?
Sure, please.
So in your likelihood, where, I know it was a toy model, but still, where does the mass gap of information enter? How does it know about the mass gaps?
Inside the integral, I had those two things, the galaxy catalog and the gravitational wave data. That gravitational wave data was giving you the distance distribution, but actually the mass, or rather it's actually the chirp mass, of course, is inferred along with the distance. So those two things are related, because you can have a very loud, a very heavy thing far away, or something much lighter nearby and for the same signal. So we have to fold that in there.
Does that probability you're saying changes when you convert, for example, waveform into luminosity distance? That very tensors?
I think I'm saying when we do. Can you say the last question?
Can you go back to that slide, the one that you had there?
Can we go back to all the builds? I didn't write the mass distribution explicitly in here, but it is in the real version of this. There's more terms, but you can think of it as basically being in the gravitational wave part.
Okay, so mass enters somewhere in that yellow thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Luciano.
Yeah, I was wondering, the low end of the mass gap is still disputed, that there is even a gap there, right? So I was wondering if this will help or not your estimation of H naught, like if it works in just one way in the higher end of the mass gap, is that actually beneficial for the method, or is the same?
So what really benefits the method is there being features in the mass distribution. Whether they're gaps or not, so whether the mass distribution goes to zero or just or not, doesn't really matter. So if that gap gets filled in, let's say, if it gets filled in smoothly, so there's just a smooth continuation of neutron stars and black holes, then we've lost features and we'll do worse. But if there's just some dip, as long as there's a sort of well-defined feature, that would help.
Thank you.
Okay, any more at this stage?
Well, so just to sort of maybe follow up on the question asked by Ghazal. So you said that in your previous, equation, that yellow part had some implicit, probability assigned to seeing black holes as a function of their chirp mass. Is that what you were saying?
I'm saying that a mass model is needed in there.
Okay, good, right, okay.
But we can change the mass model, so yeah, we can update. Okay, good,
right. And so then, for your future codes, you're saying that you will marginalize over any possible behavior for that mass function as a function of redshift? Is that correct?
There's two things in there. So for a given mass model, we marginalize over its parameters. You need a parameterized model. The way the code is set up now, I know some people have done some really nice things with kind of just trying to infer the mass distribution without just using a parameterized formalism. We're not at that stage yet. You also say as a function of redshift, and that's a separate question, because you could then have a mass model that's constant in redshift or one that evolves. At the moment, we just have a static mass distribution in there. However, it would be a relatively straightforward extension, and people are discussing it, to put in an evolving mass distribution.
Okay, but to do any actual inference of cosmology, you have to allow for an arbitrary redshift evolution for an arbitrary mass function, right? Because otherwise, then you'll be potentially biased by your model assumptions, right?
I think no one has strong evidence right now that the mass distribution is evolving. So I guess that is an assumption right now, but it's not a terrible one. But what I'm saying is you do have to vary the mass distribution. And in principle, when there's better data, we would also allow it to evolve.
In an arbitrary way, right?
In an arbitrary way. I think that's what I was trying to say to start with, that right now we don't do this in a completely arbitrary way. You'd need something like a kind of Gaussian processes method to just cover like any arbitrary shape. What we do right now is we put in parameterized models that are, you know, based on what happens in rates and populations analysis.
Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. Thanks.
I mean, maybe in future, you know, we'll build an extension, or someone will build an extension that does allow for this kind of fully flexible mass distribution. The point is, you know, right now with the current data, we don't have that kind of constraining power.
Sure. No. Of course. No, of course. You know, before this to be before this method to be interesting to cosmologists, right? You know, I mean, this method has to be free of systematics at the percent level, right? So therefore you want to be sure that there aren't any percent level biases associated with the underlying implicit assumptions about how the mass function is evolving.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes. But the data isn't good enough that we're at that kind of percent level sensitivity yet. But yes, in principle, going forward to get a completely kind of validated result, you would have to make sure you're not subject to those biases. Okay, maybe I better move on. So that was kind of where we're at with the kind of standard cosmology state of things. So I've shown you the results with the O3 data. I've told you about how we have significantly kind of improved how we can handle cosmology and astrophysics together, which is what we have to do. And of course, you know, we are on almost on the eve of the fourth observing run. So these methods will be applied to the O4 data, and of course do look out for those in future. What I thought I would do in my bit of remaining time was tell you something about how some of these non-counterpart methods can be applied to tests of gravity on cosmological distance scales. And I should stress that I am just talking about cosmological extensions of GR today. I'm not talking about strong field modifications. So the kind of picture one should have is that we're really just focusing on the propagation phase of gravitational waves, and assuming either there's no modification at the source, or that the propagation phase is the dominant kind of modification. There's a very generic way which a lot of cosmological modified gravity theories affect gravitational waves. And it comes back to this expression we had earlier with the luminosity distance. And what these extensions of GR very often do is they change the effective distance that sits in this expression. Obviously, they're not actually physically moving the sources around. This is just the effective distance that sits here. And so now we have this object we call inventively the gravitational wave luminosity distance. And that is generically not equal to the standard luminosity distance, right? If they're equal, we would say that's kind of consistent with GR. And so we're looking for modifications of this ratio. Now, what people have tended to do so far is, rather than do model specific analyses of this ratio, which of course in principle you could do, people like to try and build model independent parameterizations of this ratio and how it evolves as a function of redshift. And so this expression I'm showing on the slide is one of the most commonly used parameterizations. It comes from this paper, where we have a functional form mainly controlled by this parameter xi naught. There is an index here, but that turns out to be less important. And what this functional form does is it gives something which is, if xi naught is 1, it's just a flat line, so that's the GR value. And if xi naught is greater or less than 1, you get this set of evolving curves. And the shape of these curves, so the fact that they all coincide at redshift 0 and they kind of level off at high redshift, the claim is that that's motivated by the kind of behavior that you'd expect cosmological gravity theories to have if they are to be good dark energy models. So this gives us another parameter that we can then try and constrain with the dark sirens method. So it's the same idea, but instead, well, We will have to vary the Hubble constant as well, but in addition, we have this parameter now affecting the luminosity distance redshift relation. Sorry, the gravitational wave luminosity distance redshift relation. So everything I've said before, all that same machinery applies. So this is just showing you some preliminary results from doing this analysis with the same 42 events from O3 data. And so now we're constraining this Zinor parameter, which remember is 1 in GR. And you can see all these individual events, and I'm just showing 1D contours here for now. You get all these kind of, you know, strange variety of shapes. And this is where 1908-14 that I mentioned right at the start comes in. It's this event here. And what you notice is that it's much more bumpy than the other events. And that's because this event was loud and it was well localized. That means the galaxy catalog coverage of this area of sky, it's quite low redshift, is good. We have a high galaxy catalog completeness in this gravitational wave footprint. And so you actually start to see in that case, some of the lumps and bumps in the galaxy catalog distribution showing through. And that's what we hope will happen in future as we use better galaxy catalogs and we have better localized events, we should start to see more and more structure in these posteriors from individual events. So running the full analysis, as I've said, we have to vary cosmology. Now we're varying modified gravity parameter, or actually two parameters, and we have to vary the mass distribution as well. And this results in some huge great corner plot. I'm not going to show you the full thing. I'll just show you a kind of cut down version, which has the parameters that are best constrained or most correlated with the modified gravity parameter. So we're really looking at this row here. So with the current data, the constraints are pretty weak, right? Zinor is measured to 4.4 plus or minus, you know, about 50%. So it's pretty loose. And there are some interesting degeneracies with the Hubble constant and also interestingly with some of the mass and rate parameters. But the point is that, again, the more binary black holes we get, the more binary black holes we get, we just throw all of that data into the analysis. Really, everything will help us out here. And so, you know, again, we're hoping that by the end of 04, we'll have some much better constraints on this. I'm slightly aware of time. Can you tell me how long have I got left?
About 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay. All right. Okay, in that case, I will tell you about one more thing, which is on a slightly different note. So, keeping with the theme of tests of gravity, but moving away from the dark science method, I think it's worth briefly kind of updating folks on the story regarding the propagation speed of gravitational waves. So this is the well-known part of the story, that the propagation speed of gravitational waves was measured with the first standard siren, 1708-17. And that measurement comes from the fact that you can do a find the difference in the time of arrival between the first photons to reach you, which is the gamma ray counterpart, and the merger in the gravitational wave signal. And that time delay for 1708-17 is 1.7 seconds. And that means you can use that to put a bound on any relative difference in speeds between light and gravitational waves. And the headline figure that comes out when you do that is that you constrain any fractional change in the speed of propagation of gravitational waves, which is CT. You constrain that to be of order 10 to the minus 50. So a really, really small number. Now, that is subject to some assumptions you make about what happens exactly at the binary neutron star merger and how long it takes a gamma ray photon to get out of there. Those weaken this bound by an order of magnitude, but they don't really change the fact that it's a super tight constraint. And at the time, there was a lot of claims going around, you know, including from myself, that this ruled out a big sector of the modified gravity model space. And in particular, it ruled out a lot of what we call Horndesky theories. And Horndesky theories are basically, Horndesky is rather the sort of parent theory of modified gravity models with scalar fields. Now, obviously, that's not everything, but, you know, people like scalar fields, they're simple to work with. So there are a lot of models on archive that belong to the Horndesky family. That was the claim at the time, and that was well publicized. Things got a little bit more complicated the following year due to a paper from Claudia de Ram and Scott Melville. And they pointed out the following, that if you view this Horndesky family through the goggles of being an effective field theory, a low energy EFT for some higher theory of gravity, and we know that you can treat Horndesky in that way, that means it has a cutoff. There's some energy scale above which Horndesky breaks down. And they computed in a kind of ballpark way, and I'm not going to reproduce their calculations today, but their claim was that that cutoff scale could be as low as a few hundred hertz when expressed as a frequency. And of course, that few hundred hertz is actually sort of right towards the lower end of the terrestrial LIGO Virgo Kagra band. So what their results implied is that maybe you shouldn't be surprised that you see gravitational waves traveling at the speed of light in the LIGO band, and that maybe that doesn't completely rule out possibilities of models that deviate from the speed of light. So that's this curves dipping below one at these lower frequency regimes. Okay. And that kind of then reopens this question of what is the propagation speed of gravitational waves at low frequencies, if we allow it to be frequency dependent.
So is this cutoff scale a free parameter? I mean, if Lisa rules it out, can you just say, it's below 10 to the minus 3 hertz and it's still viable?
So the cutoff scale that they come to, I don't think it's completely free, but I believe this number comes from the scales that you have to have in your Horndesky Lagrangian and any operators you would add to that for the theory to be cosmologically relevant, right? You want a theory, okay, the assumption here is that you want a theory that does things on cosmological scales. The point I'm about to make is that LISA is therefore the way to test this. So if you allow me to just continue to the next slide, let me just kind of wrap up by telling you one thing about how LISA would measure this.
Can I ask a question? Can I,
yes, yes.
So the question that I don't understand the logic here. If I buy the argument by Claudia Melville, they said, okay, Horndesky already broke down at 260 hertz. So it's not that LIGO cannot say anything. We already have a theoretical paper that said, okay, it doesn't make any sense to look at it. So how is it that you use that statement to say, well, maybe still Horndesky, but still there is room for this kind of behavior? I'm not sure I follow the logic here. It seems one is trying to have it both ways.
Right. So I'm not hearing everything perfectly, but from what I think I did hear, yes, that is the point of the Duram and Melville paper, is that LIGO is looking in a regime where Horndesky in principle has broken down already. So the previous bounds that were placed on the speed of propagation of gravitational waves should not have been applied to Horndesky. So their statement about Horndesky being ruled out, that is now called into question. They're saying all you can really say with the LIGO data is that you've measured gravitational waves at this frequency be traveling at C. But does that answer your question?
No, really. Maybe I'll send you an email afterwards. That's okay.
Okay. Okay, I'm aware I'm probably very short on time, so let me just finish this up. So the final point here is that Lisa would therefore be the thing which potentially could check whether you do have a modified speed, at least as far down as the Lisa observations go. And it turns out the way to really do that test would be to use multi-band sources. So these are gravitational wave events. They're stellar mass black hole binaries, but they're quite heavy ones. So maybe things of, you know, towards 60, 70 solar masses, which in principle would be detectable in the Lisa band at low frequencies, maybe, you know, several years before they merge. And then they will, you know, evolve in frequency, they'll move rightwards on this plot, and they will merge in the LIGO band some years later. And you can show that if we'd had Lisa flying 4 years before 1509-14, we would have detected it. So that then what you're testing here is the situation that you have gravitational waves traveling at C in the LIGO band, and it's something different from C in the Lisa band. And what that will do is it will shift the coalescence time of your binary. So you get your Lisa data, you measure your binary really well over lots of cycles, and from that you can predict the coalescence time of the binary. And that prediction, time to coalescence, so that's T minus TC, has the GR part. And then there's a correction if you've got a modified speed of propagation, which has the form here. And basically, if you plug in the numbers here, you multiply something large by something small. I'm just doing this for 1509-14 as a test case. You get a shift of about 2 minutes in the coalescence time, which is easily detectable. So the Lisa data would forecast the coalescence time to an accuracy of about 10 or 20 seconds. And the ground-based detectors would then measure the coalescence time to an accuracy of milliseconds. So between the two, you are basically able to constrain this any change in the speed of propagation. And if we don't see such things, then you're going to get back a bound on the speed of propagation at low frequencies, which is about the same order as we had before, 10 to the minus 15 or so. So that's one way, and probably the leading way, to at least kind of regain some of that statements about gravitational wave speed. Okay, I'm sure I'm out of time. So let me just give you my kind of visual summary. I don't do wordy conclusions. So we looked at standard sirens and how they measure the Hubble constant. I explained the dark sirens method with these kinds of sketches. And we also looked at some of the real results from that right now. We understood why the mass distribution is a really important kind of entangled problem with that, but one we are making progress on, hopefully in the next observing run. And finally, just at the end, we talked a little bit about this kind of update on the story regarding propagation speed. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thanks very much for listening.
Yes. Yeah, well, maybe I can ask a follow-up question. So can we ever rule out Fondesky? I mean, it seems you can say that you have a cutoff frequency, maybe I can tune the cutoff frequency, maybe Lisa measures the same speed of light, and then you say, the cutoff frequency is lower than the Lisa band, and Fondesky is still alive. Can we ever rule out?
I don't know if there's a mic in the room or something, because I didn't hear a lot of that. I mean, were you asking about? Okay, well, you might be asking.
Can we rule out on that? So let's say if Lisa detects the same C as LIGO, I mean, and can we still rule out on that? I mean,
one could argue that the cutoff frequency is now shifted to below the Lisa detection band, and then Fondesky is still alive.
And maybe with the pulsar timing array, you could get it down even lower to 10 to the minus 9. But all you would be doing would be shifting the potential cutoff scale. So I don't think you'll ever completely seal that, but of course you just want to push it to a point where it becomes not interesting for people to pursue that model anymore.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah. Oh, there was a question by Luciano. Well, Luciano, maybe you can go and then I can try.
Yeah, Luciano, why don't you go first? Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I have a quick question. I'm sure you mentioned this, but I probably missed it. So how many more observations do we need to actually reach an interesting percent level constraint? So what LIGO round you expect this method to start, you know, shining?
So you mean how many more dark sirens observations?
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I'm going to give a very permissible answer here, which is to dodge the question, because we don't know exactly, because it depends on what we get. So it depends on what we get and how well localized they are, because as we've seen, the better localized, the better, more constraining power we get out of them. And that, of course, depends on the detectors. I don't know if you've heard that some of the detectors are doing better than others right now. So that's kind of an experimental bit that's beyond my control. The other thing that really has a major effect here that could change the game is the galaxy catalogs. So the galaxy catalog we are using right now is not optimal. We are using a catalog that is very tried and trusted and kind of has been used by the collaboration for a long time. But it's definitely not as good as, you know, catalogs now available from DES, for example. So what we would really like to do is use some of the stage 4 galaxy surveys, and that could significantly improve the constraining power. So it depends on really a combination of collaboration with the surveys and the data that we're going to get, which of course no one knows for sure right now.
Right. But there is no fundamental limitation in the method, right? Like, even if is there a way of, even if you start observing things and improving the catalog and so on, that you reach some limit of how better you improve the estimation, or this in principle can continue and you can improve. I don't know if that's clear.
I'm not aware of any fundamental limit right now. I think we could just improve. As Neil sensibly pointed out, if we do continue to improve, we might get to a point where we could be subject to biases if there's something we've not modeled correctly. We'll then have to do a lot of exploration of that. But other than that, I think we can just keep going.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Very interesting talk.
Tessa, can you hear me better now?
Yes, definitely.
Hi, thanks for your talk. Let me try and let me try again the question I was trying to answer to ask. So if I go back, so let's start with some premises. Hordensky is the most general family, second order equations, blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's the equation I'm going to look, or that's a theory I'm going to look at. Now, LIO shows that within in some frequency band, there were the results were inconsistent with it, and then, okay, rule out. But then you call in the observation by Claudia and Melville, which I haven't seen. So I'm just going to take that as face value. Suppose what they tell me is that at 260 hertz, things become order one. And then using the results by Will and Max and Tiago and Pau, I know there will be significant deviations there. So I cannot use that observation to say, oh, because they become order one, then the theory rules out, there is room for it elsewhere. I think it just says, that's it. The theory is kaput no matter what, because there is gravitational phase effect at 260 hertz. We should have a theory that is workable at that regime. and we don't have it because of their result. So what I was trying to say is, I don't think one can, at least, or in my point of view, would be to try to have it both ways, to use that result to say, oh, we don't have the right to ask here, but to ignore it when saying, oh, it still can work at our place. The theory is a single theory that comes with everything. And if it breaks somewhere, okay, then it would say that theory is gone.
Okay, so what I think you're doing is you're calling in other observations or simulations, right, where people show that if you apply...
No, I'm not calling... I could just completely shut off any possible observation. This is a theory fact. I'm going to take it, I mean, take it as granted that what Claudia is saying, that if at some particular regime, which is very, very far from the Planck regime where I would have expected things to break down anyways and then need something else, but if in the classical regime where I think I have a control theory, if any theory I propose, I know it will break down, then that would be the end of the theory.
I think the appeal being made here, and again, this is not my work, right? But I think, so the way this curve is drawn here is not quite by hand, right? But this is artificial, right? So once the theory breaks down, as you say, you can't use it. So the fact that there's a nice curve here that just goes back to one is effectively just the hope that there is some higher theory here, which is well behaved, that we don't understand the transition between Horndesky and whatever the higher energy scale theory of gravity is. So I presume the argument would be, you know, it's got to get back to C somehow. That's the loophole. If we do have some other theory of gravity that does get back to C and is well behaved, then that's what Horndesky transitions into. I mean, you could take objection to that as kind of a bit artificial, but you know, that's not my call to make.
I think, yeah, okay. My philosophy would be to say, that's it. There is no magic, but okay, if one is willing to say, well, some magic will happen at this precise regime that will save the theory, okay, fine, then that might be fine. Thank you.
But just to make sure that I understood that, so is the statement, you know, from Claudia just that the theory error bar blows up for frequencies above 260 hertz? And so is that what she's saying, actually? I mean, so below 260 hertz, we can construct this EFT where we can actually make calculations, but above 260, the EFT breaks down, and so we don't know how to make theory predictions for these sort of models. Okay, right, I see.
And then the argument, you know, the fact that this goes back to C, you can argue that you can argue that on grounds of Lorentz invariance, right? If you ever want to have, if you ever want to stand a chance of unifying gravity with other fundamental forces, you need it to be Lorentz invariant at high energies. And for that, it had this propagation speed has to go back to C. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of, that's why you're arguing that the high energy limit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Transition. But the approach to the high energy limit might happen, you know, very sharply as is shown here, or instead might happen very gradually over like many decades in frequency. We don't know, right? I see. Okay. Okay, perfect. All right, thanks so much.
Any other questions? If not, thank Tessa again for the very nice talk.